we have the need for more firefighting crews than we currently have available. So we're stretched thin.
Dozens of new wildfires burn in the interior and southwest Alaska. From the Alaska Public Radio Network, this is Alaska News Nightly for Tuesday, June 23rd. Good evening, I'm Zachariah Hughes. Also tonight, an innovative summer school class that helps students with different abilities to succeed.
There's always the freeloaders, and then there's always the really hard workers, and then there's the middlemen.
Where do you fall?
In between middlemen and freeloaders.
Those stories and more tonight on Alaska News Nightly.
Today's broadcast of Alaska News Nightly is presented by
Northern Air Cargo, providing freight transportation to 13 rural Alaska communities. NAC offers a variety of service options to get the freight where it needs to be safely. Northern Air Cargo, serving Alaska since 1956.
And by
Spinard Builder Supply. For more than 60 years, SBS has helped Alaskans build from ground to roof to everything in between. Spinard Builder Supply is here to build with you.
Environmental groups say they found a fundamental flaw in Shell's plan to drill in the Chukchi Sea this summer, and they're asking the government to rescind its approval. In a letter to Interior Secretary Sally Jewell, the group says Shell's plan to use two rigs at once violates a 2013 Fish and Wildlife regulation aimed at protecting walruses. The regulation says rigs have to be 15 miles away from each other during exploration work. Michael Levine, a Juneau-based attorney with Oceana, says the sites Shell plans to drill are just 9 miles apart.
Shell and the government may have backed themselves into a corner that neither can get out of, compliant with the existing rules.
The government insisted on Shell using two rigs per season as a safety measure. That's so one rig could drill a relief well in case of a blowout, and also to shorten the number of seasons needed for exploration. Levine says requiring Shell to just keep one rig idle isn't a solution.
The plan that Shell submitted that was conditionally approved by the government contemplates two rigs drilling simultaneously. It's not clear whether the government has or could approve a different plan.
An Interior Department official said today the Fish and Wildlife Service is reviewing Shell's program to ensure it complies with all laws and minimizes any disturbance to walruses. Shell spokeswoman Megan Baldino says its permit applications are science-based and that the company is still working with the government on the terms of its operations. Shell has received most of the approvals it needs. It has leased two drilling rigs for its Chukchi Sea work. The Polar Pioneer is already en route from Seattle to Dutch Harbor. Smoke is spreading across a large area of the state as wildfire activity grows. There were 56 new wildfires Monday statewide and 238 active, mostly in interior and southwest Alaska. KUAC's Dan Bross reports.
One of the top priority blazes in the interior is the Rex Complex fire burning off the Parks Highway north and south of the community of Anderson. Alaska Interagency Coordination Center Public Information Officer Timothy Evans says the complex consists of two fires, the over 4,000-acre Fish Creek blaze north of Anderson and the much larger Kobe fire to the southwest.
That fire grew to 14,300 acres. The fire seems to be producing its own weather. It's pushing the fire to the south currently.
Evans says firefighters' focus is on structure protection, adding that some homes have already been lost.
Six single residences destroyed and two minor structures that have been destroyed since this fire started.
Meanwhile, Evans says two fires north of Fairbanks off the Elliott Highway prompted evacuations in the Eureka area, while another blaze far to the west threatens the Yukon River village of Nulato.
There's a current recommended evacuation for the town of Nulato. It's about 200 people. The only way in and out of Nulato is by boat because the airstrip is socked in. So that's a real concern. We're sending people in there to communicate with the folks and advise them and to help the elders to get out of the community.
The fire spotted into Nulato on Monday, but Evan says firefighters were able to save the community.
With the winds, conditions and everything like that, we're doing everything we can to keep it to a minimum and try to protect these people in their village.
Numerous other interior blazes continue to crop up daily, primarily due to lightning. The 13,000-acre Blair Fire, 40 miles southeast of Fairbanks, is blamed for a dense haze that blankets the area. With so many wildfires raging, Division of Forestry spokesman Jim Schwarber says the response is getting more complex.
We've got a lot of resources helping us from the lower 48, but we have the need for more firefighting crews than we currently have available. So we're stretched thin, but we know how to adjust accordingly to keep those highest priority fires staffed up to the level where the fire suppression job is getting done.
So far this season, just under 500 wildfires have burned 324,000 acres, an early season total Schwarber describes as relatively modest.
But we are starting to have the normal high level of lightning strike activity with a very receptive fuel bed. The tundra's dry and burning actively, the forest is dry and burning actively.
National Weather Service meteorologist Don Acock says fire-conducive weather is forecast to continue this week, and smoke is expected to be an issue for several days.
Because there's no systems moving through to clear the smoke out.
Acock says some weather anticipated for later in the week could help the situation.
There could be a system moving in from the northwest towards the weekend, and also a system over the Gulf of Alaska. Between those two systems, we could possibly get some clearing of the smoke Friday or Saturday.
Acock says the systems could bring rain to the eastern Alaska range and eastern part of the interior, but it's unclear if that'll extend west to Fairbanks. In Fairbanks, I'm Dan Bross.
Another fire burning near the interior community of Tanana has prompted a voluntary evacuation in that community for elders and people sensitive to smoke. The Tizitna fire started from a lightning strike late Sunday about 6 miles northwest of the community. It exhibited extreme behavior, according to fire managers, and in less than 24 hours grew to 25,000 acres. The fire is now growing more slowly, but is moving toward the town and is about 4 miles away. Three crews, including one Type 1 hotshot crew, are fighting the fire. Fire officials are moving crews off the Whitefish Lake fire to Lower Kalskag for a staging area for protecting homes and other communities threatened by fires. Crews have been working to establish a fire line on the northern edge, but are now changing strategies. Francis Mitchell is with the State Division of Forestry.
They would be there available for quick response at Kalskag, Lower Upper Kalskag, at Chuatluk, Aniak, because there are fires near those communities.
Crews removed hose from along the western interior line so that it could be redeployed for structure protection. The fire grew more than 1,500 acres going into Monday, but there are now more than 70 active fires in southwest Alaska, and 20 started Monday from lightning. Because firefighters and aircraft are dealing with hundreds of fires around the state, only fires that directly threaten communities or occupied structures will receive staff. Mitchell says the Kalskag crew is stationed near the runway to be ready to move.
Ever-changing and fluid. That's kind of the way operations are. But the focus is on getting the few crews that are in the area in the southwest at staging points where they can be quickly deployed to new fires that threaten life.
Upriver in Crooked Creek, crews laid down hose, set up sprinklers, and prepped the town for point protection. Fire personnel will continue to focus on the western edge of the town while securing multiple structures and sites. The fire is still 3.5 miles from Crooked Creek. Officials with the Matanuska-Susitna Borough say that 55 homes were destroyed by the Sockeye Fire. That number is more than twice what was estimated last week as the fire still raged. Borough Information Officer Patty Sullivan says the original number came before crews had access to the worst affected areas.
They've been able, over the last few days, to get out and for 13 hours a day, walk properties, look around, and get a more fully, you know, scrutinizing look at what actually was destroyed.
In addition to the homes, assessment teams logged another 44 properties with substantial damage to outbuildings.
Sheds or greenhouses or even outhouses. Sometimes valuable things were stored in sheds such as dog sleds. So while it might be an outbuilding, it might still contain very dear items.
More than 300 properties have been assessed within the fire zone. The majority of them showed no signs of structure damage. However, there are still some remote properties officials have not been able to reach. Still to come on Alaska News Nightly, learning the art of being a fly fishing guide at a fancy Bristol Bay lodge.
So I spent like half the time just swaying my rod back and forth, just trying to get that perfect swing.
That's ahead. Stay with us.
Alaska News Nightly is brought to you in part by
Raven Alaska, providing business travel needs in over 100 communities across the state. Find more at flyraven.com.
And by
First National Bank Alaska, where local knowledge and experience make the difference. We believe in Alaska. Learn more at fnbalaska.com. Equal housing lender, member FDIC.
Two volcanoes in the Aleutian Chain have been showing signs of activity for years, but as KUCB's Emily Schwing reports, recent satellite images prompted the Alaska Volcano Observatory to raise its alert level and aviation color code.
Satellite imagery shows elevated surface temperatures in the summit crater at Cleveland Volcano, roughly 140 miles west of Dutch Harbor. John Power is the scientist in charge at the Alaska Volcano Observatory.
So we're seeing, you know, warm ground, increased thermal activity at the summit. Some of the radar images we have suggest that new lava has been extruded, forming perhaps a small lava dome in the volcano's summit crater.
Scientists at the AVO have raised the alert level for Cleveland to advisory. The aviation color code has also been set to yellow.
We have heightened the alert levels at Cleveland so that folks are aware that there is the possibility of increased hazards associated with any eruptive activity that might occur beyond what's apparently already gone on.
Cleveland Volcano has been extremely active for the past decade. Power says it's one of the most active volcanoes in the Aleutian Chain. But the majority of that activity has come in the way of small, long-term, low-level eruptions. A similar scenario is playing out roughly 125 miles to the east of Dutch Harbor at Mount Shishaldin.
What we see there is Shishaldin has a very deep summit crater, and down in the bottom there is activity going on. We see, you know, increased temperatures again in satellite imagery, and we believe that there is active magma sort of pooling deep inside that summit crater.
Shishaldin is the tallest volcano in the Aleutians, towering more than 9,000 feet above sea level. The alert level there is currently set to watch. The aviation color code is orange. Power says the volcano occasionally emits small amounts of ash. He says Shishaldin has been in a low-level state of eruption for over a year. Despite the recent increase in activity, Power says there's no indication of any major eruptions from any of the volcanic centers throughout the Aleutian Chain. In Unalaska, I'm Emily Schwing.
What happens when you throw a mix of middle school kids who all learn at different levels into one classroom and hand them a couple of college-level texts? An innovative, collaborative approach to teaching that gets students to pay attention. KSKA's Ann Hillman attended a summer school class at Central Middle School.
Soon-to-be ninth grader Draven Menard didn't choose to go to summer school.
I failed social studies, and my mom said that I should go to summer school, guessing kind of more as a punishment than like actual keeping up with classes, I guess.
It's the start of the second week of classes, and Menard acts low-key, almost apathetic. He says forced writing isn't his thing, but for this summer...
I like the writing class because it's actually most of the stuff that they are covering is things that I don't mind writing about.
The topic, Omnivore's Dilemma. How do humans decide what to eat, especially in a world with factory farms, huge variety, and a changing food culture? 2 weeks later, Menard's apathetic front has trickled away. He's taken over editing the PowerPoint slides for a group presentation on the merits of genetically modified foods.
I've been the person that's just been going to each one and like rewriting them to sound better, I guess.
He's a hard worker.
That's his new friend, Edward Hazelton, chiming in at the end. They'd never met before this summer because they go to different schools.
I didn't know them. I just imposed upon their group of friends.
He's a good friend though, don't worry.
The students are a mix. Some are on the gifted track, others have individual learning plans. Some just fly under the radar. But in summer school, it doesn't matter. Everyone has the same lessons, the same expectations. The class is working from the Young Reader's edition of Michael Pollan's Omnivore's Dilemma, though some kids are sneaking in chapters of the adult version on the side. They're also reading articles that challenge Pollan's arguments. Teacher Aura Beattie says the material is sparking conversations.
And they don't always all agree with each other, but they're still talking and thinking about their world, and they're making connections about their world and how, their role in it.
Reading teacher Amanda Bruski is collaborating with Beattie. She says the high level of interest from the mixed-up group of kids is pulling the disengaged students into conversations because they see the value in what they're doing. They're also asking the students to read chapters from a college-level book about the history of uranium. Yeah, the radioactive material.
And I have kids who are nowhere near it, nowhere near that as far as their reading level, but they're so interested because the other kids are talking about it. I gotta know.
The two teachers say their high expectations are helping the kids take ownership over their work and their group presentations, though some students, like Hazelton, don't really realize it.
There's always the freeloaders, and then there's always the really hard workers, and then there's the middlemen.
Where do you fall?
In between middlemen and freeloaders.
But Menard, the self-appointed group leader, doesn't see Hazelton that way.
He does try, and we really appreciate it. He's a problem solver. He thinks of things that could help him do better work, and it's a good trait to have, I think.
Though the material is complicated, Menard thinks it's good for everyone to learn it.
I think everyone of every, variety can be in this class and actually learn something.
But some students, like Madison Hill, will never agree.
Would you take a class like this again?
No.
How come?
I actually don't like language arts, but...
You're saying that from the teacher.
I mean, I don't really have a problem with it. It's just, it's not my thing.
Anchorage Middle School Summer Academy ends this week. From the Urban Affairs Desk, I'm Ann Hillman.
Alaska News Nightly is brought to you in part by ConocoPhillips, investing in oil and gas production and creating jobs and business opportunities for Alaskans. ConocoPhillips, Alaska's oil and gas company. If you're ready to quit tobacco, Alaska's Tobacco Quit Line can help with free confidential coaching and support services through the telephone and online. Now introducing Text to Quit, a way to help you use medications correctly, manage urges, and prevent relapse all from your mobile phone. Call 1-800-QUIT now or visit alaskaquitline.com for more information. This message sponsored by Alaska's Tobacco Prevention and Control Program.
A week at a sport fishing lodge in Bristol Bay costs tourists thousands of dollars. It's a major regional industry, but it is largely owned and operated by outsiders. For the past 7 years, a mosaic of organizations have run the Bristol Bay River and Guide Academy to train local kids the art of fly fishing. KDLG's Matt Martin met up with this year's group at Kulik Lodge on the last day of the week-long academy.
Jet boats hydroplane up Kulik River and float planes skip across Lake Nonvionic as Kulik Lodge comes alive for a day of fishing. David Parks, Jr. of Iliamna, is one of 15 students at the Guide Academy. He stands in the crystal clear water of the Kulik with Sarah Pearl.
So could we possibly catch something right now?
Well, I'm trying to teach you how to cast first.
No, but that's what I mean. Can we possibly
Yeah. If they're right there.
Oh, okay.
Pearl works as a housekeeper at the Kulik Lodge, but today she'll pretend to be a client so Parks can test the fly fishing and customer service skills he learned this week. Before this week, Parks had never fly fished. He'd always liked fishing, but grew up with only a typical rod and reel.
It was either that or ice fishing.
The first time he ever picked up a fly rod was the first day of class.
The next day we had to come out here and fish, and so I spent half the time just swaying my rod back and forth, just trying to get that perfect swing.
Now, after just learning the skills himself, Park teaches Pearl, another novice, the finer points of casting with a fly rod.
As soon as you feel it tightened, is that better?
Yeah, there you go.
The students had a week-long crash course in fly fishing and what it takes to be a guide.
Like tying flies and making leaders and making sure we had all our customer service skills down.
Sonny Peterson is the owner of the Kulik Lodge. He currently doesn't have any Bristol Bay locals working for him, but he says they add a great value to the services that a lodge like his can provide.
People come up there and they ask where you're from, and your guide says he's from New York or Florida. You know, it doesn't sound as good as if he says I'm from Agiogic or Non-Dalton.
The Bristol Bay River and Guide Academy was founded in part by Tim Troll. He is also the head of the Bristol Bay Land Trust. Troll says the time is about right for locals to play a bigger role in the lodge industry.
Took 70 years in the commercial fishery before locals really broke into the commercial fishery, and now the lodge industry has been here about 70 years.
Troll used to be the president of Chokyung Limited in Dillingham. The native corporation owns a sport fishing lodge, and he says shareholders would often ask him why no locals worked in the lodge.
And I asked the operator that, and he said, well, I need guys who fly fish. And Bristol Bay wasn't producing any local fly fishermen. There were maybe a handful. So that sort of planted the idea in the back of my head, is that if we are going to serve that industry, we have to produce somebody who can fly fish.
In 2008, Troll was finally able to see that idea come to life with the first Guide Academy. This is the seventh, and roughly 80 students have passed through the program, and four have been placed as permanent employees and a few other internships at sport lodges in the region. Troll says that even if most of the students don't get jobs at a lodge, they can learn about an industry that is all around them. He says many of these students may someday be leaders in their native corporations, which often own or lease land to lodges.
Just understanding the industry, how it works, how it operates, and also lodges from the other side, understanding what village corporations are all about, and trying to deal fairly with everybody and make it work.
He also says it's a way for kids to get exposure to people from all over the world.
Business leaders of the world come here. You get to mingle with these people. And who knows where that can take somebody.
Troll doesn't think the lodge industry will ever be a major employer in the region, but it could be a significant one. Sonny Peterson, owner of the Kulik Lodge, says a major hurdle to hiring local guides is that the work is only seasonal.
You know, a local kid here, it's tough for him because, you know, once this is over, that's it, you know. And unless they can figure out something to do the rest of the year.
David Parks, Jr. from Iliamna, echoes that concern.
It's hard to have just a seasonal job with, like, a box of Tide soap costing like $30, $40.
Parks will be starting a new job at the post office when he gets back to Iliamna, but he would love the chance to work at a lodge if he could.
I mean, if I had a job that would allow me to take like a month off during the summer, I'd do this job during the summers.
Yeah.
Maybe I'll work in a school.
There you go.
Work in the school in the winters, be a guide in the summer.
Whatever career path lies ahead for Parks, it's evident that this academy has left an impression on him. Reporting from Kulik Lodge, I'm Matt Martin.
A French tour boat carrying about 250 people visited Southeast Alaska last week. It's the first of several visits planned this year and next. L'Estrelle stopped Tuesday at Petersburg, a town that usually doesn't get cruise ships. KFSK's Angela Denning toured the ship along with a handful of Petersburg residents, hoping to build a relationship with the foreigners.
So welcome on board, everyone.
Thank you.
Welcome on board L'Estrelle. So you are now at the main lounge.
Christelle is guest relations for the tour ship and greets our group of 10 Petersburg residents with a warm smile.
Discovering with this beautiful city of Petersburg and beautiful place of Alaska.
It's a pretty fancy mega yacht that's 4 years old, part of a new fleet of ships owned by the French company called Pono. And passengers are paying for it. A week-long trip through Alaska this summer starts at $6,000. Inside, the color scheme is whites and neutrals, with leather furniture and wood trim. Even the standard rooms have king-sized beds, which impress the visitors.
Look at all this space.
Oh, there's two bathrooms, king-sized bed, two large closets for all of it.
There's a two-story sculpture that depicts raindrops made of hundreds of crystals. There's a spa that smells like perfume, a dance floor for live music events, and a dining hall for formal evenings.
And here we have a theater a Winning Night Theater where we have shows during the evening, lectures also during the day.
The ship is parked in front of Petersburg, which is an unusual sight. Smaller cruise ships this size show up on occasion, but the town never gets large ones. It can't. There's just not enough room for them to maneuver. The water in front of town, called the Wrangell Narrows, resembles a large river. It's a channel between Mitkoff and Kuprinoff Islands, and it's known for its tides, which can create strong currents. Today, the conditions were just right for this large ship to park.
Here we are. Welcome on the bridge.
Thank you.
Welcome.
In the bridge, Captain Jean-Philippe Lemaire greets the tour group.
We enjoy an amazing whale watching this morning. Exactly what we are looking for.
The captain brought the ship into the Narrows this time because the water was calm and the tides were in his favor.
And I guess you have not so much cruise ship in Petersburg. That's mean is why we are here. Mm-hmm. It's just the reason that we are here, because our concept is to be able to go where the other one can go. That means all the big monsters, let them go to Ketchikan, Juneau, and all the place. Because it's really our concept as a small cruise ship to be able to give another experience to our passengers.
Although the ship takes regular cruises to places like the Caribbean and Japan, it also takes expeditions to the Amazon River and around the ice floes of Antarctica and the Arctic. They have a dozen zodiacs which they take out from the ship for impromptu excursions. Lemaire says they pride themselves on their stewardship of nature. They have a dozen expedition staff on board, including 10 naturalists. Petersburg, being a small community on an Alaskan island, is just the type of place his clientele want to visit.
They are looking for how is the life here in a small community, you know, on the middle of nowhere, as on an island, and in the winter, you know. You need to give more than just a nice landscape and a nice excursion. The people enjoy a lot to feel a warm welcome of a community, to feel that all the community have a true smile and not just something too commercial.
The French ship is also scheduled to visit Juneau, Ketchikan, Haines, and Skagway this summer. In Petersburg, I'm Angela Denning.
And that's all for this edition of Alaska News Nightly. If you missed any of tonight's stories, we're online at alaskapublic.org. Follow us on Twitter at APRN. We had reports tonight from Dan Bross in Fairbanks, Ben Matheson in Bethel, Emily Schwing in Unalaska, Ann Hillman in Anchorage, Matt Martin in Dillingham, and Angela Denning in Petersburg. APRN's Liz Ruskin reported from Washington, D.C. Our editor and producer is Annie Feit. Our audio engineer is Dave Waldron. Monica Goki is our web producer. And I'm Zachariah Hughes.
Alaska News Nightly was made possible by
Arctic Wire Rope and Supply, stocking rope, chain, and boat anchors from 5 to 3,000 pounds on the web at arcticwirerope.com. Calling all adult learners, attend Reaching Arctic Communities Facing Climate Change Camp July 13th through the 17th in Fairbanks. Deadline to apply is Monday, June 29th at thepolarhub.org. This message sponsored by AINE, Association of Interior Native Educators. The Medallion Foundation and Federal Aviation Administration set standards for the operation of aircraft and airports. More information at faa.gov/go/flyalaska. This message is sponsored by the Medallion Foundation. Alaska Pacific University offers an affordable education, small class sizes, and life-friendly schedules designed to support your personal and professional goals. APU is still accepting applications for fall 2015. Find out about financial aid and the promised tuition grant and apply online at alaskapacific.edu before Saturday, August 1st. This message sponsored by Alaska Pacific University.
This is APRN, the Alaska Public Radio Network.